Sago, so hello everybody. I want to say before Clifton leaves, big yell go to my brother. Thank you for sharing a little bit and also explaining a lot about our peoples and a little bit of our history and a little bit of what's going on in some of our communities. Because I'm going to be talking about my community, Six Nations. I'm going to be talking today about, of course, the tar sands, which I was invited here to speak about. I also think it's kind of funny that. I think it's kind of funny, at least myself and Clayton, yeah, we all can get invited to very much the same things. And I was just in Germany last week during the conference, and then he had to go to Brussels this week for another win, and so he basically just said, you know, why don't you take this over? And it's a very funny little activist world that we find ourselves in sometimes. So I'm just going to be showing some photos here during my presentation. I want to start off, though, by saying, you know, for me, it's a really big honor to be invited here and to finally be speaking at an Israeli apartheid week event here. I first got involved with Palestinian solidarity issues back when I was studying in University of Waterloo about 6 years ago. I was part of what was then called Students for Palestinian Rights. And, you know, we were always talking, and I always thought it was, you know, really interesting thing, a really big idea to talk about how related the idea of indigenous sovereignty, indigenous solidarity was to Palestinian solidarity. And we tried to incorporate it in a few times, but back, especially at that time, there wasn't a very big and a wider perception of how connected the issues were. And so for me, it's really amazing that, you know, and I feel really honored that, you know, the organizers of this event dedicated an entire evening to talking about indigenous sovereignty, indigenous solidarity as well, because I think that's something that I think is very close to a lot of our hearts, and it really helps to expand some of the knowledge about those issues. I also want to just talk about, you know, some of the recent events as well. I think it's been really exciting to see some of the uprising, some of the in the across the Arab world. Really interesting, really something that I think everybody is paying attention to. One of the things that kind of struck me, I was reading a newspaper last week, was one of the negotiators for the Palestinian Authority said that, you know, everybody was, of course, very elated by all these protests, but they still felt that the sense that, you know, even if these things happened in Palestinian territories, you know, that protest alone wouldn't be enough to bring about change, and it kind of, you know, reflected on our situation here in Canada as well with a lot of Indigenous communities, you know. With a lot of Indigenous communities alone, it's very similar sense that, you know, we can protest all we want in our own communities, in our own territories, but, you know, there has to be a wider sort of movement for change in the, you know, among the settler, so-called settler community as well, that, you know, we're really dependent upon in some ways like that. You know, I think Clifton talked a lot about, you know, some of the very particular issues that are going on in our communities that I don't have to really go into a lot of depth over now. But I think, you know, it particularly stands out to me that, you know, we have a lot of recognition in Canada sometimes of, you know, what's going on in other territories, what's going on in Palestine and Israel, what's going on in the Middle East, in Africa, without recognizing that, you know, we face some of the very same symptoms, some of the very same situations here in Canada. So it's always good to sort of be reflective about that, you know, these issues are not just something that go on in foreign territories. And so as a precept to my talk, I guess, you know, I do work with the Indigenous Environment Network. I've been working with them for a number of years. The IEN, as we call it, is a, I guess, international network based in Canada and the US, but working with Indigenous communities in other parts of the world as well. That's really what set up probably about over 20 years ago, 25 years ago now, to support a number of Indigenous communities, mostly in the US and Canada at the outset, who were facing various environmental justice struggles. And it's really grown as a network since then into you know, I think, I would say probably one of the more well-known Indigenous organizations that exists out there, and one of the only ones that actually focuses on Indigenous and environmental justice struggles at the same time. And in the past number of years in Canada, we've been especially focused on working with some of the communities downstream from the tar sands projects, recognizing that, you know, this is one of the most gargantuan projects, one of the most destructive projects, you know, to ever exist in human history. And it's one that's taking place on indigenous lands and territories, right in the backyards of a number of native communities. And so I got involved in this photography project probably back in November. It was the first trip. It's probably spent about 4 weeks now traveling through northern Alberta, and probably spending about another 4 weeks up there before this project is done this summer. Basically out of a recognition that, you know, what's happening up there is again, like a lot of things in other parts of the world, it seems really remote. It seems really removed from everyday sort of life. And without really seeing the impacts, without really seeing what's going on there, we have a sense that people don't really understand what's going on. And so this was an effort to really try and capture some pictures, to really try and also take some interviews and try and really empower and get out a number of community voices that we felt were missing from the dialogue. And, you know, one of the biggest reasons we felt that way was because, you know, for us, you know, looking at the tar sands above and beyond an environmental issue, we also see it as a huge Aboriginal rights issue. And an Aboriginal rights issue in part because of the fact that starting in the 1960s, when some of the first tar sands projects were coming online and really ramping up in the 1980s, a lot of these projects were basically being pushed through by the Alberta government, by oil companies, you know, on native land with minimal to no consultation at all. And so they would basically just show up one day and start, you know, putting in staking land and putting their equipment in people's backyards and people's trap lines, and basically just evicting them off their land. And, you know, I think this is somewhat of a recognizable situation, very analogous to the situation in the Middle East and Palestine, where people would basically just piece by piece lose access to their land. And sometimes, you know, of course, have no official recourse, no ability to do anything against the government or to say anything to anybody. And so this just sort of became sort of a ingratiated project in the 1960s, 1980s, that really began ramping up in the past decade with the humongous rise in oil prices recently. And so for us, we also started to get involved because, you know, we started to recognize that what was happening there also represented a tremendous threat to a lot of indigenous cultures, to a lot of, you know, the basic ways of life that people were living. And, you know, explicitly what I mean here is the fact that in a lot of these communities, up to 80% of people rely on hunting, trapping, fishing as the main source of supply of food. And I mean, these are not just ways of getting food. I mean, these are also ways of life. These are, you know, ways of teaching young people to have a relationship with the land, to go out on the land, to practice native spirituality, but also to practice the essential, you know, education that our ancestors have really passed down throughout the generations. And a lot of these things are being threatened by some of the environmental contamination and the environmental destruction that was happening in the tar sands. First and foremost of that has been the impact on the water. And even in this picture alone, you can sort of see some of those bright lights in the background. This is a picture taken in Edmonton with one of the former chiefs of one of the native communities of Fort Chipewyan. And you know, just in Edmonton alone, you can see some of these bright lights in the background. Those are gas flares going off. You know, and what's happening in around these native communities is that these kind of projects, you know, are going on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And they're using tremendous amounts of water to try and extract some of this tar sands, which, you know, is basically one of the most heaviest and dirtiest types of oil that you can possibly extract in the world. Basically requires between 2 to 4 barrels of water per every barrel of oil that they use to extract it. And what ends up happening with that water, in most cases, it becomes, you know, heavily contaminated, and they have to dump it into gigantic tailings ponds, which you can see from outer space today. But a lot of that water doesn't just stay in those tailing ponds, it ends up leaking back into the river. And so on the one hand, you have the taking out vast amounts of water from the Athabasca River, and in many cases not putting it back. And so water levels have gone down, according to some elders, you know, as much as 1 or 2 meters over the past 20 or 30 years, making it impossible in some cases for them to get their boats out into the water, and just completely disrupting and changing a lot of the ecosystems that they're really used to. But also, the water that is leaking back into the Athabasca River is becoming extremely contaminated, and is being pumped full of a number of really toxic chemicals that are making their way up into animal ecosystems, and eventually into the food system, food stream for humans as well. And so what people are saying, people are seeing up there, has been that, you know, when they're out hunting, when they're out catching fish especially, they're seeing all sorts of growths, all sorts of tumors, all sorts of discolorations and disfigurements of these animals that have never been witnessed before. And I have a picture towards the end of, you know, one of the fish that was caught by one of the community's fishermen, and, you know, basically showing that what's going on there. You know, he said at the time probably only about 10% of the fish right today are being caught with these kind of growths, with these kind of diseases on them. And, you know, this really only started in the past 10 years. And his estimation was that they only have probably about 10 years left before they have to close down their entire fishery, before they won't be able to eat any of the fish in the area if, you know, production levels stay at their current levels. And so, you know, we have to recognize that this is a serious threat to indigenous food sovereignty, to the sovereignty of these indigenous communities to continue, you know, to practice their ways of life, ways of food. And, you know, what really threatens them, you know, once these food systems are destroyed, is that they're going to have to rely on food being shipped in from other places, and especially in some of the northern communities, which are fly-in communities. You already have them suffering from prices of, for example, a gallon of milk will be about $14 to $15. Carton of eggs will be about $12. You know, a thing of butter will be about $7. These are already tremendous prices in a lot of communities that, you know, are suffering from poverty in many cases, and would only get worse under, you know, a dramatically reduced food supply. And of course, all of these things are sort of combining. You can sort of see some of the error here into a lot of human health impacts. One of the major impacts, especially in the areas of Fort McKay, Fort McMurray, has been to people's lungs, to people's breathing systems. A lot of children, one of the nurses told me in Fort McKay that all of the children who are being born today are being born with respiratory problems. And this is completely new for them. A lot of people, you know, have humongous backup supplies of aspirin and Tylenol because they regularly get headaches when, you know, you can see the sulfur contamination from these plants, which are within probably about 10 kilometers from their community. These things are off gas, and just depending on the wind current, you know, some people aren't able to leave their houses some days. Some people, especially a lot of elders and children, you know, are completely find themselves unable to function some days because of, you know, the incredible amounts of pollution being pumped into the sky here. As well as, you know, if you travel farther up north in Fort Chipewyan, it's been one of the most widely documented communities in terms of other human health impacts, where we've seen that they've developed incredible amount of rare cancers, as well as a number of other rare diseases that previously had never been seen before, but should never even be seen in communities of maybe 2,000 people in rates of, you know, 5 in 100,000 people. You know, these are the kind of diseases that are just popping up and killing off old people. There are cases of young people getting sick with cancer, you know, in their late 20s and 30s, and sometimes succumbing to it, and sometimes surviving. I mean, these are kind of things that I think would be unheard of and really, you know, provoke an outrage if they happen in other communities. But these are the kind of things that are just taking place and normalized in a lot of these communities. There's a few pictures showing here that show some of the pictures from Fort McKay. And this is one of the men from Fort McKay. His name is Mike Orr, and he's a band counselor in the community of Fort McKay. And what you can sort of see, those little dots on his leg are he received from actually, you know, just going out in his 4x4 into the muskeg, into the bush, to go and check some trap lines. And in the community, a lot of people have started to call this the muskeg rash over the past 2 or 3 years, as, you know, regular water streams, regular water systems that they've gone into all of their lives have become, you know, heavily contaminated with oil. And so when we were visiting this community, we actually went out and with Mike and his family and discovered a tailings pond that was probably about 20 kilometers away from their community that was an open tailings pond. That is to say, normally these tailings ponds are contained behind sort of four-sided dams. This one was basically flowing freely over the land. And so we encountered it and basically found that, you know, there were animal tracks going right into this, into the tailings pond. You know, there was no system to prevent any animals, any ducks, any other, anything at all from basically wandering to this. And that there was water streams and other sources that were basically flowing freely into this tailings pond. And so this provoked a great deal of sort of outrage and outburst from the community, and even garnered the federal government's attention. The environment minister responded the same day that the sort of allegations came out, only to, you know, sort of cover it up with some sort of public relations story that, you know, everything was as planned, and, you know, they were, of course, monitoring the situation to make sure nothing else happened. But, you know, Mike's story is kind of a sort of very good one for sort of expressing the sort of changes in attitude that have been going on in a number of communities. Because as Clifton has, you know, so eloquently expressed, you know, they have a lot of our leaders by the balls, you know. They have, you know, a lot of the band councils completely bought into the system. And, you know, if it's not with money, if it's not with the you know, the offerings of millions and millions of dollars going into a few people's pockets, it's the threats. It's the threats that, you know, if they don't buy into the system, then, you know, the government will take away their power and say the community is being negligent, the community is not managing its financial resources well by not signing deals with oil companies, and they can be taken over. And this has happened in similar circumstances with other communities that have been trying to stop other resource development from going on in their communities. And, you know, basically, you know, understanding this idea that, you know, this whole usurpation is based on the theft of a lot of our land, a lot of our resources, in this particular case, you know, specifically oil. And so a lot of community resistance has come up recently in this fight to maintain community sovereignty, to maintain, you know, a sense of self-determination and protection of the rights and cultures of these communities, and to allow these communities to enforce their own environmental regulations, as well as conduct, you know, nation-to-nation level negotiations with the government and with industries. And a number of these communities have also started legal action against Canada, saying that, you know, they basically breached the duty to consult, which is, you know, one of the things protected by the Constitution of Canada, that Canada has to consult with First Nations as well as accommodate any serious concerns that they have about any of these types of projects. And of course, you know, going back to the 60s and 70s, almost none of this has actually been followed. And so you started to see recently, in recent years, a number of chiefs from Alberta and other provinces, as well as some of the provincial and territorial organizations, have started to take strong stands against tar sands development, and really represent a sort of widening political pressure being placed from, you know, the highest indigenous levels in the government. And the other sort of big thing that they've been pushing along is trying to have these things recognized, you know, as violations of their treaty rights, violations of their inherent rights that were signed, you know, in the basic treaties that allow for non-Indigenous peoples to live on the land. You know, all the Native people asked for were some simple rights to be respected, the rights to hunt, the rights to trap, the rights to fish, to be respected in perpetuity, as well as, you know, having access to the water. And so, you know, if these kind of things are being violated, then it kind of puts into question, you know, the entire validity of the treaty system at the outset. And one of the other exciting things that we saw from our trips up there was the establishment within the last 2 months of some of the youth councils and some youth groups that have been you know, more and more active in these communities, especially in the community of Fort Chip, but also in the community of Fort McKay. There have been a lot more young people lately who have become a lot more educated, a lot more informed about this issue, and have started to, you know, step it up in terms of speaking out against the tar sands or pushing for calls for, you know, moratoriums or alternative development in their communities. And it is a really big thing, because, you know, for a lot of these communities, there's just a really long history of, you know, everybody being involved in industry, everybody being involved in, you know, if it's not the tar sands, then it's something tar sands related. And so speaking out in these communities, it represents a great risk to a lot of them, because, you know, that's what your uncle does, that's what your dad does, that's what your cousin is involved in. And so, you know, for them, it's really a matter of, you know, it's really hard to be on the front line in those kind of positions and be able to actually speak out. So it's been really incredible that that we have seen some of these people make those kind of changes and transitions within their communities, as well as up to the highest levels of political leadership. We've seen a number of chiefs elected in the past few years in some of the communities that have, you know, also risen up to that challenge of speaking out and representing their communities in speaking out against the tar sands. And so I'm being told that I have about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to make the final part of my presentation, which I was asked to speak about, you know, how people can be involved, or what people can really do. I'd say the first thing is to really, I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg, really, the information and stuff that we're presenting here. I encourage everybody to read more and find out more. You can check out our website, www.ienearth.org. We have a lot more information about what's going on there. Also, there's another event that's going on Thursday night, where one of the community leaders who we showed, George Poitra, is coming in from Alberta to speak, and we're going to have some information about that and some flyers about that. That Cam, put up your hand, Cam. Hi, Cam. Is going to have some flyers with that information, and I'll also be there, and I'll also have some stuff to present there to that gathering as well. In terms of being able to help, I mean, you know, sometimes cold hard cash does help as well. So you can always donate to some of our campaigns and to some of our organizations, and as well too. There's a number of the communities that are also raising money to support their own legal defense. And so, you know, if you have those kind of resources available, those are always highly encouraged. But of course, there's always a lot of local action that I think people can also take a large role in. Because of the tar sands infrastructure is so huge and it really spreads across the country, one of the biggest things is to you know, really target local examples of that infrastructure. And here in Quebec, that includes some of the pipelines that are being planned and proposed right now, as well as some of the fracking going on, are all part of, you know, some of these tar sands companies' wider developments, as well as especially the Mackenzie Valley pipeline and the Enbridge pipeline going through northern British Columbia. These are all some of the very sensitive parts of the tar sands, you know, wider infrastructure. And, you know, especially talking in the context of, you know, action to support, you know, Palestinian solidarity, you know, we've had a lot of effort in the past little while about the whole BDS campaign, the boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. And I really think, you know, we need to start thinking about some similar ideas to support, you know, First Nations communities here in Canada, especially along the lines of, you know, a project like this, which has very much visible backers, very much, you know, people that can really be targeted. And we've already called for, you know, boycotts in certain cases on some companies, particular oil companies like BP, of course, you know, the ones responsible for the big oil spill, are also responsible for some of these oil sticks and are trying to get more and more involved in tar sands developments, but also divestment from a number of banks and other institutions, chief among them the Royal Bank of Canada. Has been a major target in the past little while, but other banks, of course, and other investment groups are also very explicit, as well as, you know, the fact that Canada is negotiating a free trade agreement right now with the European Union. And what we're really pushing for, and the reason why Clayton couldn't be here, is because we're trying to make sure that the European Union, when they sign this agreement, if they sign this agreement, make sure that they sort of exclude investment and funding for tar sands as part of this for sort of free trade agreement. And this is one of the things that we found Canada has actually been, you know, most scared about is pressure from outside countries, because they know that, you know, that's going to hit them where they really care about, which is for, you know, for the Canadian government right now, their pocketbook. So you can even sort of think of that in terms of some sort of sanction against the Canadian government if you really want to, because I think, you know, if we think about, you know, the fact that we can sort of take this kind of action against Israel, I mean, Canada also is really susceptible to a lot of these things, especially in terms of their public perception as well, because one point that I missed out from earlier is that, you know, this whole tar sands issue is really one of the things that's really driving Canada's foreign policy right now and driving their foreign affairs. You know, it's the fact that it's driving a lot of their environmental policy, it's driving a lot of their economic policy, is driving a lot of their foreign affairs and security policy as well. And I mean, I don't know if everybody has seen, well, that's kind of off, but I don't know if everybody's seen sort of the focus in recent while on you know, this whole idea around ethical oil, but I mean that's part of, you know, Canada's wider plan to try and defend and sort of sell oil sands, tar sands, to, you know, to the rest of the world and say that, you know, it's really ethical by sort of saying, you know, we can compare the ethics of these two things, like, you know, one is more ethical slavery than the other. This kind of idea of a racist, you know, conception of, okay, who's the most exploitable, you know, people in the world, and who is it more ethical to exploit? You know, which countries or which populations are easiest to exploit? So it's these kind of ideas that, you know, are really at the center of, you know, what Canada is really trying to do, and so a lot of these things need to be really attacked as well at the foundation. And I think, you know, a lot of these things really stand on the foundation of breaking out of Canada's dependency and grasp on fossil fuels, because I think what we're already starting to see is a lot of massive opposition grow, you know, within First Nations communities, but also within wider communities, even to the United States, with a lot of the pipelines, with a lot of the fracking going on, with a lot of the proposals even for nuclear power. One of the things they want to build up in Northern Alberta and Saskatchewan right now is a lot more nuclear power plants to basically power the tar sands. And I mean, don't really have to say it after seeing, you know, the tragedy unfolding in Japan, but, you know, these are things that, you know, would of course be on First Nations territories and expose them to, you know, incredible amounts of risks in areas that are also, you know, somewhat tectonically active with all this development going on. And so it's this really idea that there's a rising amount of awareness, there's a rising amount of education and action going on, I think, in recognizing that all of our struggles are connected, you know, from Palestine to Turtle Island. And so, you know, with that, I want to thank everybody for coming out, and thank you all for having invited me, and